Tonight on the docket, we commemorate President's Day with a special edition of Freedom Watch. We'll take a fresh look at six presidents you thought you knew well. The president who refused to enforce laws that assaulted human freedom. The president who suspended the writ of habeas corpus. The president who brought us the federal income tax. The president whose election brought a run in the banks. The president who could have changed the course of history in the Vietnam War. And the president who ushered in the modern era of big government conservatism. We start tonight with Thomas Jefferson, who may have been the first president to refuse to enforce federal laws he had sworn to uphold because those laws directly assaulted human freedom. Of all the founding fathers, Jefferson, more than any, rejected the Alien and Sedition Acts, which criminalized speech that put the president or the Congress in a bad light. How could the same generation, indeed even the same human beings who wrote, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech," make some political speech a crime? Joining me now is historian and Mises senior fellow Tom Woods, Fox News contributor, author, and former Nixon administration Monica Crowley, a Nixon administration aide. Nixon aide Monica Crowley.
Thank you, Judge.
And recent TV's Nick Gillespie. Thank you, Monica. To you first, Thomas Jefferson. Why did Bill Clinton trash him? Why do libertarians love him? I know I have two libertarians with me, but
right,
I want you to
right.
tell me this.
Well, Thomas Jefferson was considered the sensitive poet of the founding fathers, and in some respects, his presidency was somewhat contradictory because he did go ahead and want to expand government power in terms of building infrastructure for this new country, in terms of bringing the federal government into education. But he also realized that what they enshrined in the founding documents about very limited centralized government, he did actually try to put in practice, because when you look at his record of actual government control and power, he did try to limit it.
He did understand, Tom Woods, did he not, with his friend and Secretary of State James Madison, that the federal government was one of limited powers, limited just to the 16 items in the Constitution, and that the rest of governmental power was vested in the states. And he actually practiced that, unlike both of his predecessors and virtually all of his successors.
Well, it's indicative of his outlook that when he took office, the Alien and Sedition Acts had been set to expire at midnight just before he took office. So not only did he release everyone who had been imprisoned for saying the wrong thing, but he refunded everyone's fine with interest. But that's not to say that he was without blemish, and as I'm sure we'll discuss, there was his embargo. It was thought in New England that the searches and seizures of ships and cargoes were unconstitutional. They didn't reach the threshold it was just a mere suspicion to export
right.
was enough to confiscate your ship.
But he understood probably better than any president what he wrote in the Constitution, that
right,
our
the
rights
Declaration.
The Declaration,
yep.
thank you, that our rights come from our
Absolutely.
Humanity,
yep.
and he refused to use the instrument of government to interfere with that.
Generally speaking, and I think the Jefferson that I like the best is the author of the Declaration, where he was writing essentially a source code, if you would, of the American experiment, which ended up kind of extrapolating out into areas that he might not have agreed with, but he created the rights-based discourse that we continue to use to inform the Constitution and everything past that.
Haven't almost all presidents since Jefferson rejected the notion that our rights are natural, that they come from us from our humanity, and accepted the idea that the government, in good times or in bad, can interfere
right.
with those rights?
I think that's right. And some presidents have been better on the question than others, but I would put it as Jefferson being sort of the final, maybe the final of the founding fathers, but certainly the final of all of the presidents who actually believed that and governed that way.
Tom, was he a better thinker, a better writer, a better philosopher than he was president?
Do you mean Tom Woods?
Yes. Yes.
Oh, I don't know if Tom DiLorenzo is still there.
No, he's not here.
Well,
just
I mean,
you're the only Tom here.
Yeah.
Okay, he's the best when he's a thinker and a writer, because I think almost anybody, when you become president, well, you know, inevitably you're going to have failings. And I'll say that one bum rap that he gets is with regard to the Louisiana Purchase. People say, ah, look at this, he contradicted his own strict constructionist views. It should be pointed out he was practically alone among Republicans in believing that that did violate the Constitution. Almost all of them thought it was covered under the treaty power and that Jefferson was too scrupulous. But yes, indeed. In fact, he was better as an ex-president, too. By the end of his life, he was speculating that even the states were too big and monstrous to deal with.
Many
that instead,
of
everything should be held at the ward level.
I love him and I admire him, but there are flaws.
I think Jefferson.
He actually authorized state prosecutions for speech. He believed the federal government couldn't do it, but since that power was not ceded away and since the First Amendment was not perceived as regulating the states, he thought that the states could prosecute
which is problematic. And I think, you know, ultimately, and on President's Day of all day, you know, it's worth thinking about Jefferson as a tragic figure, where on the one hand, he was articulating rights in plain language that we continue to refer to in you know, to this day. And then in his personal life, he lived in a very different way, in many ways his political life, and it's worth meditating on the difference between those.
Tom Woods, we only have about 30 seconds. Why is it that libertarians like you and I love this man more than any other president?
Well, because he defies all categorization. I mean, he was a broad-minded, learned man who also believed in local self-government, whereas today we've come to be convinced that if you believe in local self-government, you're obviously some ignorant hick. But he thought that was where civilization flows, not from the top down, but from the people up.
Jefferson
and
also,
because he defies these categories, we love him.
Quickly,
Jefferson also established the principle of military intervention abroad. Remember George Washington's farewell address, "Beware of all foreign entanglements." Thomas Jefferson, 1803, the Barbary
Pirate. I knew you had.
We're still paying for that.
That's the fly in the ointment here, Monica. Thank you. Stay with us, guys. Did, which many don't. President Woodrow Wilson brought us the federal income tax, created the abominable Federal Reserve, and led us into World War I. But what he also did, which many don't think about, is push through the 17th Amendment, which allows citizens to vote directly for their senators. This was a death knell for our constitutional republic. Joining me once again, historian Tom Woods, historian Monica Crowley, and journalist Nick Gillespie. Tom Woods, to you first. When the federal table was created, three entities were represented: the people in the House of Representatives, the nation as a whole in the President of the United States, and the states as sovereign entities in the Senate. And senators were sent to the United States Senate by state legislatures. They were there to represent the government of the states and the states as sovereign entities and not the people in them. What happened in the Woodrow Wilson years to destroy those equal places at the federal table?
Well, if you want to talk about the 17th Amendment, it sounds innocuous, right? What could be better than people electing their own senators? That's what progressives said. We're going to crack through here for the and fight for the people. But what in fact that meant is that your senator no longer felt himself bound to the will of your state, whereas the legislators had thought of themselves as, in effect, guarding their interests by keeping him as like an ambassador of the states. Now, senators go around to major cities all over the country to raise money. They feel more tied to those donors than they do to their states. Some of the best work on this has been done by Todd Zwicky of George Mason University Law School. But the very fact that we never discussed the 17th Amendment, that it's totally off the table, means you're onto something, because most of the important issues in our country
are
off the table.
Let's advance the 17th Amendment argument to the present day. Obamacare. Would it have ever come to pass if senators had been sent by the state governments that they added burdens to?
Absolutely not, because you see that the basis of the constitutional challenges now to Obamacare are coming from the states. In fact, the two cases where the constitutionality of Obamacare has been overturned came from state-based lawsuits, not individual lawsuits or special interest groups, state. So those cases carry more weight through the Supreme Court.
Guys like Chuck Schumer in New York and Frank Lautenberg in New Jersey would never have voted for federal legislation that would have added to the burdens of the New York or the New Jersey government, or they'd be kicked out of office.
And in the wisdom of the thinking of the founding fathers, they made it a graduated system. So the House of Representatives was supposed to be the place where all the brawls happened, because they were supposed to be responsive to the people.
And elected every two years.
And the senators were supposed to represent states' interests, the 10th Amendment, and then, of course, the presidency representing everybody. And that system has broken down, and now you have more of a populist mess, and you have now states trying to clamor for their rights, where in the Constitution They were protected.
All right, talk other I want you to talk about the attitude of government, yeah. about what he did with progressives, about their, we know what's better for you than you know for your best.
Yeah, this
thoughts.
Is, I think, the real thing, the real horrible legacy of Woodrow Wilson is that he was the first technocratic president where, you know, he went to Princeton or he ran Princeton, and he knew how, like, what every price should be, what everybody should be thinking, what everybody should be looking like, and he was going to push that through every level of government, and you either got with his program or you got thrown in jail or you got kicked out of the country.
And in the Woodrow Wilson years, you see the federal government inspecting food, which normally had been done by private entities, Tom Woods, or by the state. You see the federal government telling you how fast cars can go. You see the federal government creating a central bank with the power to print all the money that it wanted. You see an utter disregard, disrespect for the previous 130 years of American history in which most of governing was done by the states. From and after Wilson, most of governing is done by the feds. Agree or disagree?
I agree completely. That was exactly his philosophy. He spelled it out repeatedly. His philosophy of the presidency is an outright horror, that if you have a great charismatic president, there is no obstacle that he can't overcome. I mean, it's the sort of thing that you would expect to hear in 1930s Europe that comes out of Woodrow Wilson's mouth. And, of course, the Federal Reserve, supposedly the progressives are going to make government more responsive to the people. To the contrary, here you have this institution that we can't even ask them for an audit these days. That would be too uppity of us. And the claim that the Fed has given us more stability is based on phony baloney statistics that even Christina Romer doesn't acknowledge anymore.
It is the absolute worst. Look, he put into place the progressive income tax. Abraham Lincoln started the income tax because he needed revenue for the Civil War.
Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional.
Correct. And Woodrow Wilson came in and then institutionalized it. But also, don't forget another big crime of Woodrow Wilson, international law and international governance.
For the first time, makes its way into American jurisdiction.
Brought it here to the United States and with the League of Nations.
And
that was
he resegregated the federal workforce in D.C. I mean, this guy
After Reconstruction, it integrated. Yeah. And right. Last word on him, he was not from New Jersey. He was from
Richmond, Virginia. He always claimed to be a proud son of Richmond.
All right. Thanks, guys. And now a few items from our President's Day Freedom File. A few stories about American presidents that you may not have heard before. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR as he's known today, is lionized by historians as one of the greatest presidents ever. He came to office during the depths of the Depression, where he launched the New Deal, which greatly expanded the power and scope of the federal government. Many credit these with bringing the U.S. out of the Depression, while others claim our country's current big government problems were directly related to FDR's overreach. Joining me now, historian Tom Woods, historian Monica Crowley, and journalist Nick Gillespie. Nick, I'll give you the first shot at FDR.
Okay, well, I got one good thing to say about all these presidents.
What could that
possibly be? It is that Roosevelt ran on a campaign promise of getting rid of Prohibition, and he helped follow up on that.
Right.
One of his posters was actually two beer mugs, and then with Roosevelt and Garner. Isn't the
Great Depression great because FDR made it great by extending it even beyond his own lifetime?
Absolutely. And, you know, FDR follows up on Wilson in this pretense to knowledge and just this massive hubris that he would be able to fix all the problems, that he was wise and he could take in all of this information that no single person or no market system could put together and figure
it
all out.
It was sort of a Wilsonian cult of personality that FDR created for himself. FDR was the original modern, don't let a good crisis go to waste president, because he went and he used the Great Depression as an excuse to seize banks, seize gold, and what he ended up doing is establishing the modern precedent for this kind of government intervention in banking and currency. And you're absolutely right, Judge. His policies prolonged the Great Depression by sucking private capital out of the private economy.
Tom Woods, FDR actually confused his job with the Congress a couple times. He actually thought that he could write laws. I think he was president for no longer than 2 weeks when he declared that nobody could own gold and the federal government would confiscate gold. And here's the price that the federal government would pay you for gold. And if you didn't give your gold to the federal government, he'd come and lock you up. Of course, the Congress a few months later caught up with that and made it the law of the land. But for a while, what was being enforced was just the president's executive decree, right?
And of course, the Congress acquiesces in this, as it always does. It retroactively endorses what the president has done. And now there was at least one case where the Congress actually stood up, and that was when later in his presidency he said that the top federal income tax rate ought to be 100%. And finally, Congress intervened and said, now, wait a minute, that's just ridiculous. It shouldn't be one penny more than 93%. Well, thanks for standing up for us, Congress.
Right. Why is this president, who increased the power of the state more than Lincoln, more than FDR, and many of whose plans are bankrupting us today, like Social Security, why is he so revered?
Well, I think because you have a lot of historians who are writing history who are on the left who consider him a great hero, a lot of progressives, a lot of liberals who think that he did absolutely the right thing in expanding the welfare state, especially during the Great Depression when people couldn't provide for themselves. Let's also not forget, Judge, about his attempt to stack the Supreme Court.
Which, of course, cowed the Supreme Court and terrorized them into finding things that were blatantly unconstitutional.
That was an appalling abuse of power.
I mean, he's the father of the blowing up of the Commerce Clause, of the jurisprudence that led to the government being able to do whatever it wants and be sanctioned by the Supreme Court, constantly was flouting constitutional restrictions of the presidential power as it came to treaties, international relations, things like that.
Tom, military historians today say that FDR knew that the Japanese were coming on December 7th, 1941, did nothing to stop them, and actually may have actually manipulated them into doing it because he needed a reason for us to enter into World War II so that he troops to Europe and help liberate Europe from Nazism. Agree or disagree?
I'm not so sure that that can be supported. I mean, I know there's some suggestive evidence to that effect, but I talked to Bettina Graves, whose husband Percy Graves wrote one of the key revisionist works on that, and she told me she doesn't see an absolute 100% smoking gun, but there's a lot of suggestive stuff. But the key thing to me is that the policies that FDR pursued, for example, like trumping up a couple of cases in which U.S. destroyers got fired on and claimed that they were totally unprovoked, when these destroyers were reporting on the location of German submarines to the British who were dropping depth charges on them, when the president does things like this and lies to the public, at some point we have to ask, when are the public entitled to the truth? When can they be treated like adults?
Do you think that the Republicans regretted the amendment that prohibited more than two presidential terms? It stopped another FDR, but it didn't let Eisenhower run again in 1960.
Yes, and I think Bill Clinton to this day is ruining the day that we have that amendment on the books.
All right, guys, thanks very much. This president served less than 3 years in office, but is cited as the political inspiration for our last two Democratic presidents. What kind of a president would he have been had he served his full term? And who killed him? That's next. John F. Kennedy was America's youngest elected president. His time was cut short, but it was still significant. He's considered an icon by Democrats and even by some Republicans. Would the history books look different today if he had lived and served two full terms? Would he have done things differently than his successor, Lyndon B. Johnson, on foreign intervention in Vietnam or big government in the form of the Great Society here at home? Joining me now again, historians Tom Woods and Monica Crowley, and my journalist buddy, Nick Gillespie. What Republicans revere him today?
Well, I think Ronald Reagan had some soft words to say for him, but I think war hawks love Kennedy. Kennedy won the 1960 election by lying about a missile gap. I think the real problem with Kennedy, what goes to the heart of what was rotten at his vision of government, is that great line that gets quoted all the time, ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. A complete reversal of natural order, that, you know, the government exists to protect the people. We're not there to add to their balance sheet.
Listen to this quote from President Kennedy in which he asked for a tax cut. And tell me if you've heard something like this from any Democrat since he said this.
Right on.
Such a bill will be presented to the Congress for action next year. It will include an across-the-board, top-to-bottom cut in both corporate and personal income taxes. It will include long-needed tax reform that logic and equity demand.
That logic and equity demand. Tax cuts across the board. Have we heard that from any Democrat since him?
No, we have not. And this is why a lot of conservatives
From Bill Bradley. Has said that, and actually,
in the White House.
Certainly not.
But this is one of the reasons why conservatives tend to isolate Kennedy as a Democrat that we could have done business with, because remember, the top income tax rate at the time when Kennedy came in was 91%. So he did do significant tax reform.
Do you think, Tom Woods, that we would have had the awful, humiliating experience in Vietnam if JFK had stayed in office rather than dying and being succeeded by Lyndon Johnson?
Well, there's a lot of speculation about this. Andrew Bacevich, in his new book, Washington Rules, isn't buying it, because it was Kennedy who increased the number of advisors, so-called, in Vietnam from about 700 to 900 up to just about 17,000. He authorized them to engage in combat, and he never did anything to contradict anybody in his administration who said South Vietnam, which was a complete irrelevant backwater as far as the U.S. was concerned, was a vital interest of the United States.
Why do you
think... seems a little bit difficult to get out of that.
All right, Tom Woods, why do you think JFK dropped the ball at the invasion of the Bay of Pigs? Did he have a problem with the CIA? Were they getting ahead of the curve? Were they doing things that he hadn't even authorized?
I think he had said from the beginning that, I will authorize this up to a point, but then beyond that, I don't want to be implicated. I want to have clean hands. I mean, to his credit, at least we can say for Kennedy that he rejected the plan of his Joint Chiefs of Staff, Operation Northwoods, whereby, which we now know because of the Freedom Information Act,
right.
It was a plan whereby American civilians were going to be targeted by the U.S. government and killed and kidnapped and all these other things and have it blamed on Castro to justify an invasion. I mean, we came that close to that type of thing being carried out in this country, and Kennedy said no.
I want you to make some news here, if you can, because you were a personal assistant to Richard Nixon in his years after he left the
White House. Last years of his life.
Okay,
yes.
When he was living in northern New Jersey.
You had nothing to do with his horrible presidency.
I was a mere embryo when he was elected.
Can you tell us about a phone call between President Kennedy and former Vice President Richard Nixon at a crucial point in American history?
Yes, well, remember, they ran against each other in 1960, and as Nick points out, that whole campaign was spent with each side trying to out-hawk each other on missile defense or the missile gap and so on. When the Cuban Missile Crisis began to unfold in the earliest hours of the Cuban Missile Crisis, the first phone call that John F. Kennedy placed for advice was not to his brother Bobby, it was not to his father, it was to former Vice President Richard Nixon.
Very interesting. Yeah. Is the CIA behind his death?
I don't think so. I'm going to go off the path here. Yeah, no, I'm going to say Lee Harvey Oswald, who was a Marxist-Leninist by his own word, who had defected to the Soviet Union, who was a Castro supporter.
Right.
I think he pulled the trigger, and I think he acted largely alone.
Largely alone or largely, totally alone?
No, I'm just saying, I'm sure he told people. He also shot at Edwin Walker ahead of time. In order to make a mystery out of Kennedy's assassination, you got to get rid of Oswald pretty quickly. And man, he is there front and center. And it's an easy shot.
Got it.
If you got a Dealey Plaza.
Thank you, guys. After this, we take a critical look at the Gipper. Is he America's greatest modern president or just another big spending, big government conservative? Next.
Now, it doesn't require expropriation or confiscation of private property or business to impose socialism on a people. What does it mean whether you hold the deed to the or the title to your business or property if the government holds the power of life and death over that business or property? And such machinery already exists. The government can find some charge to bring against any concern it chooses to prosecute. Every businessman has his own tale of harassment. Somewhere a perversion has taken place. Our natural unalienable rights are now considered to be a dispensation of government. And freedom has never been so fragile, so close to slipping from our grasp as it is at this moment.
No, never before as it was at this moment. 26 years before he became president, that speech in behalf of the presidential candidacy of Senator Barry Goldwater is better remembered than anything Goldwater or LBJ themselves said during that campaign. But by the time he became president, did Ronald Reagan still have small government values in his heart? Take a listen.
We're here to speak for millions in our inner cities who long for real jobs, safe neighborhoods, and schools that truly teach. We're here to speak for the American farmer, the entrepreneur, and every worker in industries fighting to modernize and compete.
Sounds a bit like he may have changed his tune once he got into office. Still with us, historian Tom Woods and historian Monica Crowley and journalist Nick Gillespie. Was he the father of modern-day big government conservatism, or was he the libertarian that we all thought he would be when we were kids in the 60s?
Yeah, now he was no libertarian, and that's for sure. In an interview with my magazine Reason in 1975, he said, libertarianism is the heart and soul of conservatism, and I'm no libertarian. So we had it on record 10 years before, 15 years before he took office. He created the modern warfare state. What people don't give him enough bad credit for, he also jacked up the modern welfare state. This is a guy who fixed Social Security, an immoral system that screws over poor people most of all. Bad on all counts.
Why do we love him so? Was it the sunny disposition, the marvelous personality, the tremendous difference between him and Jimmy Carter in terms of the way we looked at the presidency and even looked at ourselves?
Well, I think he had a tremendous emotional connection with the American people, and he was unafraid to stand up for conservative principles. Any presidency is going to be a complex mix of compromise and principle. Reagan was better than most. He did cut taxes. He did cut regulation. He wanted a strong dollar. He let Volcker raise interest rates to try to tame inflation. He did do all of that. Here was his mistake. His mistake was that he brokered a deal with the Democrats. He said, okay, I will go for tax increases, but for every dollar of tax increases, you're going to commit to $2 in
well, they
spending
never went
cuts.
Along with that.
And the Democrats betrayed him, and they never went with the
cuts. All right,
cuts.
Tom Woods, you probably don't agree with anything that Monica just said.
Well, I mean, almost all the deregulation, believe it or not, it's hard to believe, occurred actually under Jimmy Carter before Reagan even took office. The taxes on net, the taxes went up. If you look at over, I mean, yeah, we had the marginal tax rate reductions, but you got the payroll taxes, you got the 86 Reform Act, you got the closing of the loopholes. So, and in fact, basically, the Congress more or less approved the Reagan budgets with only marginal changes. So I have a soft spot in my heart for him because I loved his speeches, I loved his rhetoric, but we cannot let him become the rights Obama, where we love him because he makes us feel good. No, we have to be cold and calculating as historians when we evaluate
these
people.
I love him too because he made us feel good. But was he a more small government, natural rights thinker in 64, which is long before he's governor of California and 26 years before he becomes president, than he was in 1984 when he was running for re-election, Tom?
It's hard to say. I mean, when he took over as governor of California, he did not govern California as a small government conservative. So something happened. I don't think we can judge the man from just the one speech. Clearly, he did seem to believe, by and large, that the New Deal programs were here to stay, and he wasn't even going to repeal the Department of Education, which he had pledged to do.
His 1980 campaign platform was called the New Federalism. He was going to break things up and give block grants to states and take power out of Washington. He ended up consolidating power in a way that Jimmy Carter couldn't even dream of doing.
In the third paragraph of his first inaugural address, he says, I would remind you that the states formed the federal government and not the other way around.
Now, that's right.
Didn't that cause those of us who believe that the federal government is one of limited powers, didn't that make our hearts leap?
Yes.
And then didn't our hearts sink?
Yes, yes. President Nixon had a phrase about this. He said, look, when presidents are candidates and in their first term, they're warriors. That's why you got that 1964 clip from him.
Right.
They're warriors and they can afford to stick to their principles. By their second term, they want to be known in their legacy as peacemakers, whether it's domestic by giving away the store or in terms of peace treaties with foreign enemies.
Tom Woods, Monica Crowley, Nick Gillespie, it's been a great hour on the American presidency. We'll do it again next year. Thank you for joining us.